Tonight we're on week three with Anthony, so welcome.
Well, thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Anthony, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. My sober date is May 1st, 2016. My home group is the Pathway to Power Big Book group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor is Mickey M. I also sponsor a bunch of guys. I want to thank Mark for the invitation to come out and share my experience. Once again, this is week three, and it's just been a really very unique opportunity to, you know, to have 6 weeks to come and share my experience with the work that we do in this program. When I got here, it's funny, we were kind of talking before the meeting, and I was talking with one of the young ladies here, and she made a comment how she got a lot closer to a spiritual connection with a creator in Alcoholics Anonymous than ever at church. And I think that, when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, or when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had experienced so much brokenness, and I could see how broken I really was, and how I really did have a need for something greater. I'll just kind of recap where we are. We're going to talk about inventory. We're going to begin to talk about the inventory process, and the kind of impact that I had on my recovery and also on my life. But when I rolled up to Alcoholics Anonymous, every area of my life was I was bleeding. I was losing blood profusely. Every area of my life was in disarray. My personal relations, my sex relations, my employment status. When I got here, I was indigent. And if you don't know what indigent means, that means I was penniless and I was homeless and I was just out of answers. The way I had been living my life had brought me to where I was, and I was really suffering. And I was in a homeless shelter, and I called my sponsor. And I got to tell you, I remember that conversation will stay with me for the rest of my life, for the rest of my days, living and breathing under the sun. And I called him up, and I was in a homeless shelter, and I had nowhere to go. They had dumped me off. I had been in an ICU for 2.5 months. And I called him up, and I was just crying my eyes out, In fact, the only word I can think of that really describes what I was going through was I was just weeping, from the innermost depths of my being. I was in so much despair, and I was telling him about my life, and one thing that Tom didn't do was he didn't cut me off, He didn't tell me, Anthony, you just don't want it bad enough. Anyone ever hear people say that in the meeting? That guy just doesn't want it bad enough. I wish people would stop saying stuff like that. Because I got to tell you, I was crawling into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted it more than anyone in that room. And I just couldn't get what you had. I just couldn't do what, listen, people were telling me, and I don't think these are bad suggestions. They're not bad suggestions. When you're new, it's a good suggestion to go to a meeting every day. But people were saying, just go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was trying to do those things, and I was putting one meeting in front of another meeting in front of another meeting, and then bam, I'd pick up and I'd start drinking and I'd start doing other things, and I'd be out the door. And Tom never said those things to me. You know what he did do? He listened. He listened, and I went on and on and on, and I probably sounded like an insane lunatic, but you know what? He passed along something to me. There's a section of this book that says that, obviously we cannot transmit something we haven't gotten. I used to think that was a lot of like hoopla about my knowledge about the big book or my knowledge about the 12 steps. And where I am in my sobriety today, it means something completely different. What he passed along to me, was something that he'd experienced, and he gave me the greatest lesson of any of one of my sponsors, and I've had a few different sponsors since I got sober, and he passed along something to me I like to call unconditional love. That's a power, and I pray that I can be in possession of that one day, and I can also carry that on to people I work with and people who call me and ask me for help. But I went on and on and on about all these people that screwed my life up. You know, I went on and on and on about my mother and my father, how, you know, they weren't there for me. You know, my mother abandoned me at times when I was a child. You know, I went on and on and on about my ex-fiance, how she just screwed my entire life up. You know, I went on and on and on about my brothers and my employers. I had a grudge list a mile long. And you know what? He just listened to me and he said, Anthony... At one point, he interrupted me and he said, "Anthony, I'm not even gonna argue with you. I wouldn't change my life for yours. Your life sucks." That's what he said to me. He said, "The condition you're in, I wouldn't want it. I don't know anyone in my life right now that would trade their life for yours." But what he said to me was, he said that the reason you're in the place where you're in today has nothing to do with any of these people or these institutions or these things that you've been going on and on and on about. The reason your life is in the condition it's in is a result of the choices that you've made. The choices you've made in your life, the choices you've always made in your life, and the choices that you're going to continue to make in your life unless something deep down inside of you changes. Something needs to change in you. And I heard what he said, and I understood what he said. You know what I mean? When something goes from here to here, it goes from the head right to the heart, and you just have an understanding. And I knew what he was saying was true, and I knew something needed to change, but I wasn't really sure how to do it. I was a guy that was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and had some experience with this stuff, you know? I was also a guy that tried to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried to recreate all the things that once worked for me, and I wasn't able to put it back together. You know, I was in a meeting once, and I'm just going to kind of pass this along to you guys because it carries some depth and weight. You know, I stumbled into this meeting in North Hollywood in California, and I had, you know, I had about the same amount of time that I have right now, and I wound up picking back up. And I was desperately trying to. I was trying to hold on to all the things that I had collected in the time that I was sober. I had this beautiful girlfriend. I had a condo. I had a career, you know, in the entertainment business. I was living out in Los Angeles. I didn't want to lose all these things. So I'm desperately going to meetings and desperately trying to recreate this thing I once had. And I walked in and I heard this speaker, and it was a woman, and she was speaking from the podium, and she was saying, you know, telling her story, I met this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. We fell in love. We got married. We had an AA marriage. We had an AA baby together, right? I fell in love. I was with him for 17 years, and then he picked up. And she said, and I'll never forget what she said. She said, "For those who come in and have an experience with the 12 steps and actually experience the power of God, for those that pick up, they hardly ever make it back." And I heard that, man, and it crushed me because I, as a looking back thing, I understand that she was talking to the pain that she felt, the pain that she went through. But I made it my truth. And I just couldn't seem to put time back together. So here I am, and I have this sponsor, and, you know, he takes my call and he fields my call. And I wound up, make a long story short, I wound up down in Mississippi, and I started to go through this book with him. What he told me was, he said, "The only way I know how to bring about a change in you is by having an experience with the 12 steps. But the problem with you is that you've experienced some of these things before. And some of the things that you've said, some of the things that you've done. So, you know, listen, you've written some inventory. You've made some amends. You've sponsored some guys. You've experienced a little bit of the power that we access in Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "It's going to be a little bit more difficult with you because everything that you think you know actually isn't helping you. It's standing in your way. It's actually stopping you from accessing power. It's stopping you from accessing love and forgiveness and accessing all of the things that we normally access in Alcoholics Anonymous." And so he gave me the set-aside prayer, and I know you guys say it in this, and he said, write it in the front of your book, "God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, about my recovery, about my disease, and most especially about you, dear Lord, that I might have an open mind and an open heart and a desperately, desperately needed new experience with you and with all your children. Please help me see the truth." He told me to say that every day. And we went through the first three steps. And last couple of weeks we were here, we talked about those three things. So if you guys just want to open to page 60. And we're going to just, I'm just going to start with the ABCs. Because, you know, listen, the first two steps are really about seeing the truth. I've got to see the truth. Listen, I come in and, the first thing they tell me I need to do is I need to see the truth about myself. You know, and I saw that loud and clear in the first step. So it says this, our description of the alcoholic, which is step one. I went through a very thorough step one experience, right? The chapter to the agnostic, right? Opening up my heart to being willing to believe that there is some infinite power and love in the universe, and that I can access this power, right? And see that God could and would if you were sought. Now, I look at it like this, right? Steps one and two are about me seeing the truth about my powerlessness and me seeing my need for God. Step three, I'm asking God for help. You know what it says in the third step prayer? And it says it a couple of pages. If you'll just skip to page 63, it says, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me. To build with me. You know, we take this third step and we're telling God that we are going to work with Him. We are going to take certain actions, right? And I took this third step prayer. I took it on my knees. I took it with a sponsor. And here we are at the end of page 63, and it says, next we launched. Next we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Listen to what they're saying. We launched. Listen to that word. Like, what launches? You know, when people say launch, you know what I think of?
A rocket ship.
You know, when I was in the fifth grade, what was the name of the one that went up and it exploded in the sky? Oh my God, the Challenger. I was in the fifth grade when that happened. We were all excited about the rocket ship that was going to blast into outer space, and it went up, and as soon as it went up, it splattered all over the air, and all those people died. But when I think of, you know, the word launch, I think of a rocket ship. This means we waste no time. My sponsor literally slid me a notebook and said, start writing. You know what I mean? Listen, the first time I went through the steps, he didn't take me through this book line by line, which I went back through with another sponsor line by line. He really wanted me to get to the other side of this and start making amends and start working with others. He slid me a notebook and he said, now start writing all the people you're angry with. Start writing all the institutions you're angry with. Start writing all the principles that you're angry with. You know, on the following page it says this, though our decision, meaning our third step decision, was a vital and crucial step. And this is a warning. You know, this is actually a warning. Though this third step decision was a vital and crucial step, meaning it's life-sustaining and it's crucial. It's absolutely crucial that we take this step. It could hold little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in myself which are blocking me from God, which are blocking me from love, which are blocking me from intimacy with each and every one of you. You know, look, this speaks to our condition. What is my condition? My condition is I'm disconnected with God. My condition is I'm disconnected with my fellow man, right? I cannot feel okay in my sober skin. I can't connect with you. I cannot experience intimacy. So what do? I get loaded. You know, let me tell you something. Anyone who tells you that alcohol has no power is a liar. Alcohol is a powerful substance. I take one belt of it and all of a sudden my problems are solved. The way I relate to you instantly changes. I can talk to the women. I can pal around with the guys. I can feel comfortable in my skin. I feel connected. I feel a sense of intimacy. That's what alcohol did for me. Right? So this is a strenuous effort to face and be rid of all those things that are deep down inside of me that cause me to feel that way. That caused me to be disconnected. Because if I can remove these things, if I can face and be rid of these things, I can find connection. I can find love. I can find intimacy. I can be okay. Therefore, we started on a personal inventory. This was step four. It says here that taking a commercial inventory, I'm not going to read this whole thing line by line, but it says that taking an inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. In another part of this book, fact-finding, if we're looking for facts, we're going to search. This is a searching. And a fact-facing, I got to be pretty fearless. This is a searching and fearless process. And I want to just let you know that if you're new here, the people who do the first three steps and then stop, they don't take this level of searching and this level of fearlessness into their lives and their recovery program. They almost always pick up and drink. Listen, I've sponsored a lot of guys. I've probably taken north of 30 guys through the 12 steps, and I've lost more. Right? And the ones that I lose, they usually pick up and drink. Some of them die. But the people who actually sit down and do this inventory and get to the other side of it, they make their amends and they start working with others. They almost always stay sober. I mean, it's a fact. So it's an effort to discover the truth, And one prayer that my sponsor gave me was every time before I sat down and I wrote, he told me to write on the top of the page, God, please help me see the truth. God, please help me see what I need to see. Please help me discover the truth. This is an effort to discover the truth about ourselves. And I got to tell you, when we talked about the dishonesty, and we're going to talk about that today, I was driven by so many lies and delusions about myself. I could not see myself for who I really was. You know what I thought when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous? I really liked when you guys would say, we're not bad people trying to get good, we're just sick people trying to get well. Anyone ever hear people say that? And I get why people say that. It kind of softens the blow for the newcomer. But the truth was, when I wrote this inventory and I put it all down in black and white, you know what I realized about myself? I wasn't a very good person. I was a bad person. And I desperately needed to get good. I was also a very sick person, who desperately needed to get well. And I'm not arguing. If you like to say that in an AA meeting, say it all, it's great, But I got to discover the truth about myself, and I got to see the truth about myself. So a little further down the page, it says resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And my sponsor asked me, do you believe that? Listen, I just went through an inventory and I was reading all this resentment inventory to my sponsor, And he said, man, that almost sounds justified. What you just read to me, and it was personal, I'm not really going to do a fifth step in here. But he said, that sounds like justified anger. The problem is, people like us can't afford justified anger. We can't afford to walk around. It disconnects us with the universe. It disconnects us with one another. Resentment is the number one offender. It says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Let me tell you something. And I think it destroys not only more wet alcoholics, but it destroys more dry alcoholics than anything else. One experience, and I just want to share it with you guys, is I was going to a lot of meetings, and then coronavirus hit, and I didn't see, you guys remember, everything was shut down, and we all went to Zoom, and I didn't see anyone for months. I was home in my house. And one of the first things that opened was an Italian ice place by my house, and I went down there, and I cruised down there, and I see this guy that I hadn't seen in months, and he was like one of these guys from AA that just kind of, those people who you just kind of try to avoid sometimes, they just get under your skin. And I saw him coming, and I almost avoided him, but I said, you know what? I said, I'm going to say hello to him. It's been a long time. And he came running up to me and he said, hey, man, did you hear about so-and-so? And I said, so-and-so? I'm not going to repeat people's names. I just don't think it's an anonymous program. And I said, are you talking about so-and-so who was, 26 years sober from the Friday night meeting? And he said, yeah. I said, no, I didn't hear anything about her. What happened to her? And he said, well, she killed herself. Yeah, she killed herself. And I thought? I thought of this. Resentment is the number one offender. Destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And I got to tell you that someone who has 26 years under their belt and they have all that spiritual pride, the last thing they want to do is pick up a drink. But when resentment really settles in and it really starts to corrode, it says, the next line says, from it stem all forms of spiritual sickness, spiritual disease. I didn't understand what that meant when I first read that line. Today I understand what that meant. Today I understand what that means. From it spring all kinds of selfishness and self-pity and dishonesty and fear, 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 fear. You know, in the third step it says we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking, self, 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 self. This is where I see that when I write this inventory. But it says this, right? It says, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out both mentally and physically. That's a powerful promise. That's a powerful promise. Because when I first come into Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor starts breaking down that first step and he starts to talk to me about the physical and the mental aspect of the disease and the spiritual sickness, right? He says it's a threefold disease, but you know, listen. Don't point a gun at me from your seat, and you know, plan to assassinate me for saying this. But you know, when I read this a certain way, under a certain light, I start to think that maybe this is a onefold disease. Maybe if I straighten myself out spiritually, the body and mind follow. It's a onefold solution. What we have is a spiritual solution to an illness that really affects every area of our lives. So in dealing with resentments, here are the directions. Here are the first calm directions. We put them on paper. We set them all out on paper. We listed them out. People, institutions, or principles. You know, and listen, you know, institutions could be anything. AA was on my resentment list, right? The Catholic Church was on my resentment list. The state of New Jersey was on my resentment. The state of California was on my resentment list, right? I had politicians on my resentment list. I had political parties on my resentment list. You know, it says this, right? Principles. I have this little note here from my first sponsor. Sayings, laws, or rules. Listen, there are a number of sayings just in Alcoholics Anonymous that really used to just get under my skin, you know? There was this one saying that people used to always say, they still do say it, you'll probably hear it. Like, you'll probably hear it this week because I brought it up in a meeting. And they would say this, you know, religion is for people who are afraid of hell. Spirituality is for people who've been there. But I would sit in my seat and I would grit my teeth and I would think in my head, you think you've been to hell? But, you know, listen, if it makes you angry, you got to write about it. You know, the purpose of this is to face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me from God. You know, and the truth is, if every time someone says that in a meeting, it makes me angry, I'm being blocked off from the person that just said it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I need to write about it. I need to see what comes out in the fourth column. I need to take that to my sponsor and I need to take that to God and I need to have that cast out. You know, because I will tell you that most of this has been cast out for me. There are some resentments that continue to come up, but so you make a list, you know, and the way I did it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Now, I'm just going to say I've done inventory a few different ways. I've done it the Big Book Awakenings way, which is an endless inventory. It just goes on and on and on and on. My current sponsor says this, if it occupies your mind, it goes on paper. No need to write down everyone under the sun. I came to him, I said, brother, I got 30 names. He goes, 30 names? That's almost 6 years of sobriety? He said, taper it down. That's what he said to me. Taper it down. Only things that really occupy your mind. Because, and especially when I'm working with a newcomer, you know, I don't want to keep you in inventory endlessly. You know, I don't. And especially when it's a brand new newcomer, I don't ever give them even an extended third column. I just follow the directions of the book. Let's get you to the other side of it. Let's see what's in the fourth column. Let's see our truth. And let's get beyond this. God can take us beyond where we are, period. You know? And I've got to, you know, listen, as a sponsor, and I'm just going to say this, My only job as a sponsor is not to be some kind of big book guru. It's not to be someone who controls everything in someone's life. My only job as a sponsor is to get whoever I'm working with to get their hand in the hand of God. Because I cannot keep them sober. There's only one power in this universe that can transform a heart, that can heal a broken heart, that can mend a relationship, that can make a life, that can transform a soul. And that power is not Anthony C. You know? So, the second column, we asked ourselves why we were angry. Well, you know, it says, if we look on the next page, it says, Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife. Yeah, that would make anyone angry, wouldn't it? The guy wants my wife. He wants to bang my wife. You know what else he did? He told my wife about my mistress. Oh, my God. Can you believe the balls on this guy, Mr. Brown? You know what? I used to have I don't know if you guys have ever been around to, like, conferences and stuff, but every once in a while you go to an AA conference and you see people selling T-shirts, and one T-shirt that I've seen them sell, and excuse my language here, but it said it on the T-shirt, Mr. Brown is an asshole. You know what I mean? And the truth is, like, this would make anyone angry, right? This would make anyone angry. How about this? Brown, not only does he want my wife, but he wants to steal my job. He wants to take my job at the office. And I want to tell you something. I love the way, you know, Bill Wilson was just an incredible writer, because when you look at what he wrote, you know, all of us have felt this way about it. All of us have a Mr. Brown in our lives. I had one, and I'm going to tell you, his name wasn't Mr. Brown. I'm not going to say his real name here, but let's just call him Miguel, you know? And what happened with Miguel was, he was a very close friend of mine, and, you know, I was living with this girlfriend, and I, you know, she, you know, found a shoulder to cry on, and it was my friend Miguel, you know? And my mind started to create all these things. He's trying to get in her pants, he's trying to do this, he's trying to move in, he's trying to take my job, he's trying to take my wife. This guy, he wants to replace me, you know? And this is common. You know, if we want to just skip down the page and we see my wife. Let's look at the wife. She misunderstands and she nags. Look at this. She wants Brown too. Dude, listen, they're really trying to pull a fast one on me here, right? Not only does Brown want my wife, but my wife wants Brown. You know, and as a result, she's trying to take the house and put it in her name. I mean, this would make anyone irate, would it not? So, let's look at the third column. It says, in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including our sex, our sexual relations, were hurt or threatened or interfered with, right? So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been hurt or interfered with? We're looking at the third column. If you go all the way down the third column on the page there where it says pride, that's the first place where it says pride. So these are the seven areas of self, right? And here they are. Self-esteem, pocketbooks, ambition, personal relations, sex relations, security, and pride. Those are the seven areas of self. Now, I've done this a number of ways. The first time I went through the steps, I did it exactly how it is in the book right there. I turned it a notebook on the side. I listed the name. I listed the causes. I listed all the areas of self for each cause. Now, if you look there, it says his attention to my wife. Well, that affects my sex relations and my self-esteem, right? It says he told my wife of my mistress. It says that affected my sex relations and my self-esteem. Notice that fear is bracketed there too. You know, listen, and we'll get into that when we start to talk about this fear inventory. But that's the way I wrote it. That's the first way I wrote it. The second time I wrote it, I went through it and I wrote an extended third column. Meaning I wrote something on every area of self. I still have the cards here that I was told to fill out some cards. Self-esteem, how I see or feel about myself, right? Start the sentence with, I am. You know, and this was an interesting way to go through it, right? So, Brown, his attention to my wife. I'm the Casanova. No one should try to take my wife. You know, it gives me an idea of what some old ideas were. You know, one thing here, Sex relations. This was one definition that a sponsor gave to me. My deep-seated beliefs about what a real man and a real woman should be. Right? You know what I kept writing over and over and over again, and it kept popping up again and again and again? You know, a real man takes care of his woman. A real man takes care of his woman. A real man takes care of his woman. During the fifth step, my sponsor stopped me and he said, "Wait, what do you mean by this? A real man takes care of his woman. What do you mean by that?" And I said, "Well, a real man takes care of his woman. He buys her a house. He buys her a BMW. He gets her a fur coat. He gets her a diamond ring, right? He takes her out all the time. He takes her out to Broadway shows. And pop, 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 pop." You know what my sponsor said to me? He said, "Anthony, you make $50,000 a year. With an idea like that, how are you ever going to satisfy a woman? Maybe how a real man takes care, you know, of his woman is he shows up with honesty and he shows up with integrity, right? He's honest, right? But you know, I really took a look doing it this way. I really took a look at a lot of the old ideas that were driving a lot of my behavior most of my life." And then the third way I've done it was I wrote an extended third column where I really wrote how I was affected. Well, my self-esteem was affected. Well, I have the same definition, the way I see or feel about myself. So how do you feel about it? How do you see or feel about myself? Well, I feel like I'm a ladies' man, right? And I feel like my wife should not pay attention to Brown, right? So how does Brown affect my self-esteem? Well, Brown bruised up my self-esteem pretty badly because he tried to cheat with my wife. He tried to steal my wife. How does he affect my pride? How I think or feel about me, about myself? Well, how do I think or feel about me? Well, I'm a pretty good husband, and I shouldn't be threatened with. Well, again, listen. So on the prior page where it says our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to the causes and the conditions. The causes are the second column, the conditions are the third column. This is how they affect me. This is how they bruise me up. You know, my pride gets bruised, my self-esteem gets torn apart. You know, it says this: we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. That's where they say the extended third column comes from. I honestly, when I work with a newcomer, a brandy new guy who just can't stop drinking, I never, ever, ever tell him to do an extended third column. You know why? The book doesn't tell me to tell him to give him an extended third column. You know, and the other thing is, I don't want to get too tied up with process. Now, it's different when I'm working with a guy who comes to me who has... right now, I'm working with a guy who has 20 years of sobriety, and he came to me for a new experience. Now, he's got the time to sit down and write a full-blown extended third column and a very, very descriptive fourth column, just the way I was taken through by one of my sponsors. But I honestly just try to stick to what the book says. So, let's just look at the fourth column. And I want to just... You know, what's funny is... You know, when we really look at the selfishness in the fourth column, and we see how we were selfish, these first three columns become the dishonesty and the fear. You know, and it becomes all the lies. You know, if I really looked at what was going on with Miguel and what was going on with the woman I was living with, the truth was, I was disappearing. You know what the selfishness was? I was disappearing for days and days and days and days and days and days, right? I wasn't coming up with the rent money at the end of the month, right? I was carrying on with mistresses, right? Just like here. He says Brown told my wife of my mistress, right? I wasn't showing up at all like a man should in a relationship. I lied. I was dishonest, you know? But you know what's funny? When you really look at that, and you look at Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, because of my selfishness. You know, this is 1939, too. So in 1939, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have connection the way we do today. Probably Brown was the only place, the only person. It was a guy that knew the family through the husband's job, and it was probably the only person that the wife could cry, you know, could cry on a shoulder, you know? And she probably went to Brown My maniac insanity tells me the lie that he actually told, that he knows about my mistress and that he told my wife about my mistress. That's a lie. That's delusional thinking. He's trying to get my job at the office. I'm probably not showing up the way I should. I'm calling out of work 3 days a week. I'm coming in late all the other days. They're at the brink of firing me, right? But I've convinced myself that Brown is out to get me and he's going to take my job. So, when we look at the fourth column is on page 67, referring back to the list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs other had done. We resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish? Where had we been dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And the last thing we talk about is fear. We talk about fear. And I'm just going to talk about the fear inventory for a minute. I've written the fear inventory many different ways. Anytime I'm angry, anytime I get angry, anytime I'm showing anger toward my brother, the root of it is I'm afraid, right? The root of it is deep down inside I'm afraid of something, and I could never see my fear. I could never see my fear loud and clear the way I do today. And I want to tell you that the greatest gift that I've received in sobriety and the greatest thing God has done for me is He's allowed me to see. He's allowed me to see the truth about myself. He's allowed me to see the truth about my resentments. He's allowed me to see the truth about my fear. And so if you guys want to just flip to page 68. Actually, we're going to start at the bottom of 67. Notice the word fear bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. The short word touches every aspect of our lives. It is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Stealing is like a conscious act, is it not? Right? I mean, when I consciously decide to walk into the 7-Eleven and to steal, whatever it is, the iPhone wire, whatever it was, I used to steal all kinds of stuff, like for no reason, but I'd make a conscious decision to steal. And, fear is a conscious decision for me to rely on myself rather than God. That's what it is. And the whole purpose of the fear inventory, I've written it a number of different ways. I had one sponsor that had me write a fear inventory where I wrote a tally. I just tallied up all the fears from columns 3 and column 4. I had a sponsor that had me write, what's the fear? What's the underlying fear? What's the fear that underlies that fear? And what's the fear that underlies that fear? But the most useful fear inventory that I've been given was given me by my current sponsor. And I'm going to read some of my fear inventory because it had such a deep impact on me. And it's a very simple inventory. We don't really have directions for a fear inventory in the book. So I'm just going to read what it says. It says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. There's a direction, right? So they're telling us to list our fears as we see them, right? Even if we had no resentment in connection with them. I don't know about you guys, but I'm deathly afraid of the dark. Anyone afraid of the dark? Oh my God, I hate, there are times where I'm a 46-year-old man, and if I wake up in the middle of the night after I watched a horror movie and it's dark, and I fear that there's evil spirits everywhere. That didn't crop up in resentments. But I need to write about that. Because again, fear is something else that blocks me off with intimacy. It blocks me off from intimacy. It blocks me off from receiving the power of God. It blocks me off from receiving the power of love. So we put them out on paper even though we had no fear in connection with them. That's the first column. We asked ourselves why we had them. That's the second piece of inventory. Why do we have this fear? Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? That's the third piece of inventory. So, the third piece of inventory is a notation of how I deal with the fear, right? It's a notation on what are the things I do to deal with the fear that's blocking me, and that's an evil and corroding thread. So I'm just going to actually read a couple of pieces of inventory here If I have, let me just open. I picked a couple of pieces out when I was at home. So I had this fear of being abandoned. Anyone have that fear? Anyone afraid of being abandoned? Right? So I have a fear of being abandoned. I have this fear because my mother abandoned me as a child at Pathmark on Staten Island. I felt that she abandoned me. She left me in this parking lot. And I felt that to the innermost core of my being. Also, women have abandoned me over the years. When I rely on self, I abandon people before they abandon me. I run away, I sleep with women, I use them, and then I leave. I'm not trusting and relying upon God to take care of me and to protect me. Here's another one. I have a fear of being alone. Anyone have a fear of being alone? Woo! Big one. I have this fear because I don't like the way it feels to be with myself. I don't like being separate or apart from others. When I rely on self, I end up high and drunk. When not drinking, I find I stay in toxic relationships well beyond the point of normalcy because I will do anything to avoid feeling this way. I'm not trusting and relying upon God to take care of me and to protect me. You know, the whole purpose of this fear inventory is to help me see the truth. I have a lack of God reliance. In fact, the whole purpose of this inventory is to help me see the truth. I do not rely upon God. I'm separate and apart. You know, the last thing is the sex inventory. And I want to say this. This was kind of difficult because it's hard to cover three inventories in one group. And these inventories really made such an impact on my life. They changed the way I look at myself. They changed the way I look at relationships with others. They changed my relationship with God. Interesting that the young lady I talked with said that in the beginning. She said, you know, when I came to A, it changed my spirituality. It changed it for good. The level of self-searching that we do in this inventory process is unlike anything I've ever done at church. I used to do confessions when I was a child, and I would come in with a list of seven things and I would confess it to a priest. That was not on the same level as writing an inventory. I was really able to see the nuts and bolts, the causes and the conditions that made me the person I was. Now, this last inventory was the one that I feared writing. I didn't want to write it. And to be honest with you, if I'm going to be perfectly honest, I had so many sex problems coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been sexually molested as a child, and I had a lot of difficulty with relationships with the opposite sex. I always did. I never had a successful relationship. And I came in here feeling different than each and every one of you. And I was afraid to write this inventory and to share this inventory with another man. It's just the truth. But this inventory, believe it or not, is on page 69. And, it's funny because, like, do you think Bill Wilson, has a sixth sense of humor? I do. I believe that. But so here it is. And it says, we reviewed our contact over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? And you know what? That sums up every single relationship I ever had. All I was selfish and dishonest and inconsiderate. That's the truth. Who had we hurt? And you know what my sponsor said? Don't only look at the relationship, but look around the relationship. There was one, it's funny because the guy who just walked in the room was a guy I've known most of my life. And there was one resentment I had, and it was in connection with a woman that really did me a wrong turn. I felt I did some really nasty things to her too. But what happened was I was involved in a business deal that involved all these people. It involved this friend and several other friends, and we got involved in this theater company. We had all pooled our money together, and we put together all of these productions. And I dropped out of everything. I turned on one of my friends and I said, "Man, you've been connected to this, and I don't want anything to do with you anymore, right?" And not only did I not want anything to do with him anymore, I didn't want anything to do with anything he was related to. So I removed myself from the theater company. I removed myself from the group of friends. I hurt a lot of people, And when I wrote this sex inventory, even though the inventory was about the girl, I realized that I hurt Michael, Rich, Lars, and everyone else connected. Her mother, my father. Look around the resentment. Really be honest with ourselves. Who did we hurt? You know? And in my most recent sex inventory, almost every single one, I added myself and God. Because I definitely did harm to myself. When I do harm to others, I harm myself. I harm my soul. And I harm my Creator. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? We really need to think about this question too, man. Because I may do it not knowing. I may do it today. I may be carrying on with one young lady and then, you know what, I have this other young lady in the program who really understands me. So I share 10 steps with her. Right? She's in a relationship as well. You know, am I taking actions that may unjustifiably arouse jealousy, bitterness, and suspicion? You know, all around me. Where were we at fault? And probably the most important question in this entire inventory is what should we have done instead? It doesn't say what could we have done instead. You notice that? It says what should, because what could I have done is what I did. You know what I mean? But what should I have done instead? You know, and not what shouldn't I have done? You know, the first time I wrote this inventory, I said, well, I shouldn't have dated the girl to begin with. And my sponsor said, it's not asking you what you shouldn't have done. What should you have done? Get that all out on paper. And you want to know something? I went through relationship after relationship after relationship after relationship, and all the things that I should have done looked the same. Well, I should have dated her longer before I slept with her. I should have courted her. I should have treated her like a lady. I should have held doors open for her. I should have took her out to the movies. I should have took her out to Broadway shows. I should have bought her gifts. I should have remembered her birthday. You want me to just... I had this one relationship. I lived with her for 5 years. I really did to the body. I loved her to the best of what I knew how to do at the time. You know? I relapsed. I met her in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a beautiful young lady. She gave me the opportunity to sit down and do a face-to-face amends. You know? And I laid down a whole ton of stuff on her, man. You know, and I was really bad to her. She saw the worst parts of Anthony C. Animal. Disappearing for days and days and days. Extended stay hotels. Prostitutes. Cheating. Lying. Deceiving. Not coming up with rent money. And I laid all these things out. You know? And she said, Anthony, I'm really, really happy that you're sober today. I knew you were really sick. I've forgiven you for all those things a long time ago, but you know what the one thing you left out at? And you left it out and it drove me crazy. She said, the 5 years we were together, you never remembered my birthday once. You never remembered our anniversary date once. This is someone I said I loved. And I couldn't even see this when I wrote inventory. And I want to just stress to you that the inventory process is not just writing this fourth step and reading it to our sponsor. It's going to God in 6 and 7. And it's going out to the people in the inventory in 8 and 9. And to the best of our ability, hearing their side of the story and trying to make restitution for those we've harmed. But probably the most important part of this sex inventory is that last question. What should we have done instead? You know, I had my first sponsor, Tom. He did a very specific sex ideal. You know, it says, in this way we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life, right? I mean, that's the whole purpose, right? Is to actually create a new ideal for ourselves. So he said, take everything that you wrote on all these different entries in what should I have done instead, compile a list, right? And especially the ones that are repeated over and over and over. So I put together a list. He said, now I want you to take all these things and I want you to write a prayer. I want you to write a very intimate prayer going to God and asking him to make you and to mold you into all these things moving forward. And I went home and I wrote a very beautiful prayer and I bought it. And I'm a pretty good writer, you know. I don't have a copy of it here with me. But he said, I brought it back, and he said, now, that's great, and that's awesome. Now, I want you to hard laminate this prayer, and I want you to say it every day upon awakening, right? And truth be told, I probably didn't do it every day upon awakening. I probably did it a few times, and then it fell off, and then I would call him, and he'd say, well, are you saying the sex ideal prayer? You know, every time I call him because another relationship went sour. You know what's interesting about these 12 steps? These are spiritual exercises. None of us do these things perfectly. If you're going to sit there and say you do this perfectly, I'm probably going to say you're full of it. You know, that's the truth. But the more of these things we do, the closer we get to the power. The closer we get to the resurrection power, to the transformational power that we can access in this program. You know, I just want to read one more thing, and then we'll end it on this. It says, you know, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. And I think, you know, listen, this is a warning here, and I think that it's important because we're not perfect. Is anyone here perfect? If you're perfect, raise your hand, man, and we'll go on a march together. We'll be the perfect people in sobriety. I'm not perfect. You know, I fall short of my chosen ideal a lot, right? Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but it's only a half-truth. It depends on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and we have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our own experience. Now, I'm just going to share a quick story and then I'm going to turn the meeting over to you guys. And I will be brief. I know I'm running out of time here. But I was about 2 years sober and I was doing the deal. I had, you know, I was with my second sponsor. I was going back through the steps a second time. And, you know, I had this sex ideal and I had this thing and I was trying to live. But I'm searching around, right? Because I'm 2 years sober and I think now it's time to have a relationship. And I'm searching around and I'm trying to find this, like, you know, great girl to date. And I meet this girl online and she looks like she, you know, it just adds up. She's like a Yankee fan. And she's like, you know, literally shows up. I mean, I took her up to Yankee Stadium with one of my good pals, and she shows up with a Paul O'Neill jersey on. And this friend of mine was like, dude, you should marry that girl, he says to me, right? But I started going, and she said, you know, listen, I drink a little bit, but I have a couple of glasses of wine with dinner. You know, and I said, okay, I'm cool with that. I'm not, you know, I'm an alcoholic, but I don't care, you know, as long as, you know. And so we went out a couple of times, and the first time it was like, you know, she had a couple of glasses of wine, and the second time she had a couple of glasses of wine, and the third time she had a couple of glasses of wine, and then she had a bottle of wine, and then we went back to the apartment, and she was, you know, shuffling through the freezer to pull out the bottle of vodka, and then she's cutting herself, and I'm like, oh my God, she's one of us! You know what I mean? But it was like I had already had this intimate, you know, thing with her. I began to sleep with her and so forth. And so I called my sponsor and I told him, and he said, look, man, it's no big deal. You know, she likes to party. You're on doing the sober thing. Just let her know that you can part as friends and that's it. And so that's what I did. I had the conversation with her and we went our separate ways. And then a couple of weeks later, I start getting, you know, texts at like midnight. Bzz, bzz, bzz. Hey, what are you doing? You guys know what that is, right? And booty calls, right? And so, and I started showing up. And this was going on for weeks. Weeks. That I'm literally having sex with an intoxicated person. You know, and I'm not saying anything to my sponsor. I'm not saying anything to any of the people in my network. Until finally I was in so much pain over it that I just broke down and I called my sponsor. And I was like, dude, you don't understand, man. I'm sleeping with a newcomer. He said, but you know what he said to me? He said, man, you're not sleeping with a newcomer. You met her on a, you know, you met her on a site. You met her on a dating site. He said, but you are in jeopardy. Because if you don't do exactly what I'm going to tell you, you're going to drink again. He said, what you need to do is you need to pick up the phone and you need to call this girl. And you need to have a conversation with her and tell her that while you had a good time with her, you don't want to make her feel guilty about the sex. He said, you had a good time together, but you're just not going to do this anymore. And if you ever need help, I'll be here for you.
Take care. Be well. That's what they mean, man. I did carry that through. And, I, you know, it's a whole other story, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to you guys now because I went way over the time. But she did eventually reach out to me for help. I want to thank you for another week at the Westfield Big Book Workshop, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to you.